You're listening to the good.
Don't call me Paino.
The bad.
Absolute.
And the rugby.
Folded like a deck chair.
With Paino, Lord, and the Husk. I don't know what that means.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Good, The Bad and The Rugby with me, James Haskell. And for the first time ever, Alex has taken a holiday. I believe he's somewhere in the French Alps in a relative's chateau or schloss, as it would be known. And I've been left with tins of Tindletown and me at the helm.
Well, it could be the last Good, The Bad, The Rugby with us steering the ship. It could go in any direction, but I'm looking forward to it. We have a great guest that's going to help bring joy and laughter to the masses.
Listen, this is going to go smooth and silk. Don't worry about that. So as I was saying, hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Good, The Bad and The Rugby in partnership with City Index, the global provider of spread betting, CFD and Forex trading. We're really glad to have partnered with City Index as we cover the highly anticipated Lions series. And if you missed it, it's worth checking out the video we posted last week to launch this partnership. Once again, a star acting from myself, Tins, and Paino, the geography teacher. Over the next few weeks, we'll be running loads of competitions with merch, tickets and experiences up for grabs. So keep a lookout across our social channels to enter. A massive thanks to City Index for partnering with us for one of the most hotly anticipated events in the rugby calendar. So where did you watch the Lions game this weekend?
I was very lucky to be up at Silverstone. A big shout out to Camp Kerala, who had myself and the wife over on Saturday and Sunday. Yes, I was watching it up there, and did you watch the Grand Prix?
I did. Do you know what? I did. I watched both. I was actually commentating on the Lions for TalkSport, but I thought Marcus Smith's performance was next level. And I know it was only against the weaker opposition before everyone gets overexcited, but I thought for somebody so young who'd never been on tour, he was mercurial.
Yeah, I agree. I can't argue. I think I had a little sort of say on it whilst I was cycling around the track at Silverstone after the qualifying race on Saturday, which was a surreal but unbelievable thing to do. Yeah, again, as a player, you go to the next level and you see if you can step up. You just cruise through it so easy, and it's going to be interesting. Are they going to need sort of an X-factor player on the bench just in case things aren't quite going in Test rugby and you need to change it? If Finn Russell's calf or Achilles isn't still right, is he going to be brave enough? I think we know Gats will make brave calls, so I don't think that's the issue, whether he'll get that shot or not. But again, comfortable run out for the Lions. Obviously, quiet first half, but then, you know, sort of got the ball rolling and then just cruised through it, didn't they?
Are you confident for this weekend?
Yeah, look, I think it's going to be interesting. Well, I think there's going to be some interesting selections dilemmas. Obviously, Alan Wynn coming back, having those 28 minutes. Does he go straight into a test start for next Saturday? You know, who's going to play in that second row? I think there's quite a big debate around that. Back row, yeah, I've said for a while now that I think Courtney's been the best back row really on the tour, but people are still putting in. I saw
Ty Byrne was brilliant.
Yeah,
I thought
I saw, you know, Sam Warburton put Byrne in at six. That's going to be a tough call on either of them, whichever way that goes. I think Elliot Daly has suddenly looked like he could play 13, which I'm not saying that in the Oracle, but I said straight off the bat because I think it's his best position. So there's definitely still places up for grabs, and there's going to be some tough calls in there. What you do with the back three, you know, you see people leaving out Hogg, who would have thought the Six Nations player of the tournament, and you're going to leave him out. And so then you've got Curry and Watson who have played. Yeah, there are big calls all over the place, but they're good headaches for Warren Gatland to have. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, in my conclusion on that, I completely agree with you. I think there's obviously, you know, a preconceived idea of what the team is going to be. I think Warren Gatland probably would have had that. But so many players have now kind of rejigged that. And albeit we've only played one real test, I think the opposition have been pretty poor most of the time. But someone like Luke Cowan-Dickey, when he came on against Africa, was unbelievable. Yeah. I think he's played himself into a starting jersey. I thought Ali Price again on the weekend just added a bit of dynamism that the Lions perhaps were missing. But a man who actually knows far more than me about playing for the Lions, being on three tours, an expert on this week's The Good, The Bad and Rugby in partnership with City Index, one of the tallest men to have ever played for England and the British and Irish Lions, possibly the only second row to have scored a drop goal in the Premiership, and surely the only player of all time to have a chicken called Princess Bubblegum. Simon Shaw, how are you, sir?
Oh, very well, mate, very well. That's a lovely introduction. We've covered everything, I think.
Where are you? Yeah, that's it. And that, thanks very much for coming on board. Yeah. Where are you? What are you doing?
Just in Aix-en-Provence. I had an early anniversary dinner with my good lady. It was my son's birthday yesterday. We left him on a beach somewhere halfway through his birthday to come and celebrate our anniversary.
On his own, obviously. Tell him he'll get home on his own.
No, not on his own. No, with a couple of mates. But then we had photos from him lounging on a yacht going out to the Porquerolle Island. So didn't feel very sorry.
I love how you traded in your kid for your missus. Just you're like, who's going to be more upset? It's anniversary or the birthday. Missus is going to win every time. What did you do for it? Anything really romantic?
We went around Aix-en-Provence, did a bit of, she did a bit of shopping. I just kind of stared off into the distance. Did a bit of a bar hop, restaurant hop, and I had one of the most disgusting starters I've had in my life. It's still repeating on me now. So the quicker we move on, the better.
And I know, obviously, your good lady very well. I'm hoping that she's not just wandering around Aix-en-Provence with your credit card.
She is, indeed. She's.
Oh, dear.
Well, I've got one of those cards that pings every time she's spent something. So if I run through the door now, you'll know that she's spent far too much.
Obviously, you fully embraced the French life. How did you make such an error with your starter? Like, talk me through, how bad can a starter be? Was it frog's legs with snails or something?
It's one of those things. I've been here 10 years now, and I can speak a pretty decent level of French, but like going into a butcher's shop, going to a fishmonger's, eating at certain restaurants, I haven't got a clue half the time. And it just gets lost in translation. The more I enter into conversation with the waiter, the harder it gets, because the rule of thumb in France is if you speak a bit of French, don't attempt a decent French accent. If you attempt a French accent and you do it well, they immediately assume that you are absolutely, you speak perfectly well in French, and they just go off on one. And you just completely lose the plot. So that's what happened last night. I ended up with some sort of smoked kipper. I don't even know. It was called a snape or a scape or something. It was horrible. It happens to me all the time. Like, I have conversations with people, get myself in all sorts of pickles. I don't know if I tell you about the geese?
No. Tell us everything.
Please tell it.
So, yeah, like halfway through lockdown, the first lockdown in France was pretty severe. Jane actually got COVID really, really badly. So she was in bed for eight, nine weeks. And I was looking after, trying to educate four children in French with no Wi-Fi. It was just like the worst ever. And I couldn't talk to anyone because I was just getting this really negative content loop about the whole thing. And it's like fried my brains. And then this restaurateur in the area rang me up, and he's a really nice guy. He's like a really kind of deep thinker, and he sits up in his little cabanon in the hills and talks to his animals and stuff. And he rang me up and says, everything all right? And I said, look, it's tough, man. It's really tough. I'm struggling a bit. And on this particular day, I woke up, tended to Jane, sorted the kids out with their Wi-Fi, had a different phone on different data systems, trying to get them to do their kind of online learning. I went up to feed the chickens, which you alluded to earlier, and they'd been devastated, been literally ripped apart. And I was like, oh, Jesus Christ. And one of the kids obviously left the gate open or something, just torn apart by foxes. So I've gone, oh, I'm dealing with all this. And then on top of that, I've lost all my chickens. And he went, oh, I'm so sorry. He said, and this is all in French. He said, what you need to do is you need to get yourself a guard dog. And I said, yeah, 100%. But at the moment, I can't afford to buy fencing, let alone the guard dog. And then he started getting really fast in his speech. And I lost his train of conversation. I was like, yeah. And just said, d'accord every now and then. And we, to keep the conversation going, because I didn't want to defend him or anything. And then at the end, he goes, okay, well, literally, I hope you have a good rest of the day, and I'll look after it for you. And I was like, what's that mean? Literally left it at that and just thought, oh, I'll go back to him because I've cleared up all the feathers and whatnot. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, Jane's like now not fully recovered, but she's better and she wants to go shopping. She's coming back from the shopping trip. And the phone rings, it's on loudspeaker, and it's Nene, this guy. And he goes, Shorzy, where are you? I thought you'd be at your house. And I said, oh, no, I'll be back in 5 minutes. I said, why? He goes, well, I've got your dogs here. And I was like, what? And Dane, literally, you can imagine, just turns around and goes, what the hell have you done? Like, are you mental? You've chosen dogs without me. I was like, no, I haven't. I don't know what he's talking about. He's obviously gone mental. And he goes, come on, come on. And he said it in the plural sense. And I was like, oh, no. No. Anyway, I drove up the drive. And he's standing there with a box. And I'm like, what? I was just, you know, hoping for the cutest, lovely, like, fluffy dog. But I was thinking, well, he's not going to give me one of those because he's a guard dog. And then these two, like, beaks came out of the box. I was like, what the fuck? And he gave me two goslings. And I was like, what the hell? But apparently, like, geese used to look after royalty in France back in the day.
Tins.
She goes, they're the best guard dogs ever. They'll attack anything that comes anywhere near your chickens. I was like, really? So then I ended up these two geese. And they were just like, honestly, the best tonic ever for kind of taking your mind off things. And so I'd like basically rear them as my own. And they became like, literally, they follow me everywhere. And
but hadn't the horse bolted and the fact that all your chickens were dead? So you had geese.
What exactly
were the geese protecting?
Yeah, well, they were protecting me from myself. And yeah, so now we've got full flock protected. All is good.
But now they love you. They actually sit outside the house and protect you rather than the chickens are just getting ransacked by the foxes again.
Yeah, if you came up the drive, they'd properly go for you. If you came anywhere near.
Shorzy, I was going to ask you about sort of life in France. And we've only been going 2 minutes and I'm already crying with laughter as to what, like, I thought you'd sort of fully indoctrinated yourself in France, but it sounds like you're a bit like that policeman for a low hello, just walking past.
I am. I have one set of neighbours that like me and the rest hate me. Mayhem.
Well, I mean, why did you stay in France? Obviously, you know, you've been all over the world, but, you know, it's an interesting choice. Obviously, you finished your career in Toulon. Why France?
You know, I mean, from my WASP days, I've been at WASP for 15 years, something like that. man and boy. but I came back from the 2011 World Cup and my first squad meeting, I didn't know anyone. Like, I knew a couple of people. I didn't know the coaching staff because all the coaching staff had changed. Wurzel was still there and Payne was still there. But aside from that, I thought, well, you know, I deserve a change. And I'd been incredibly loyal to WASPs. I was 38 then. I just thought, well, I've got like one, if maybe 2 years left in me. I want something different. And I got offers from Japan. I just thought, chasing around at 100 million miles an hour is not going to be my thing. Plus, like, living in one of those little paper houses with no garden with four kids wasn't going to work for me. So I just thought France would be nice. And then when you look at France and look at the clubs in France, there's only sort of a couple that really appealed to me. And it, you know, it does come down to the weather and you know, being by the beach or being, you know, somewhere culturally interesting like Paris. So ultimately, the first chance I got or the first club I visited was Toulon. We arrived down there. It was kind of autumn, so November time, and it was, you know, near 30 degrees. We watched a game and I just went, this is me all over. And I spent 2 years entirely pain-free down there. Like you, I know you've joked about my inability to train from Monday to Friday, but genuinely one of the best decisions I've made because I felt amazing for 2 years. You know, not one ache or pain in my body apart from breaking my little toe. That was it.
Did you not at 38 think I've started in 1972 at Bristol? did you not think after 20 years of playing professional rugby that you thought, well, maybe I'll give it a break, but you still wanted two more years?
I've always disliked the training element. When I say the training part, I don't mind the competitive element on the pitch or whatever, but I don't like the training for training's sake. So I don't like, you know, running or going to the weights room. French training methods in unison with what I like to do. So I love playing the game. Simple as that. I didn't particularly like training for the game. I love playing it. And I got my kicks out of the weekend. And actually, all my years in the Premiership, the weekends I loved the most were playing in the European, in the Heineken Cup or the European Cup, and going to places like Toulon or Toulouse, Clermont, these big rugby town cities where it was a religion, and the support base was extraordinary and vocal and passionate. You know, I love Adams Park as much as I did, but you never really could replicate the kind of atmosphere that you got in these big towns, in rugby playing towns in France. And that was a big appeal for me as well. And playing in front of the Toulon crowd, you know, week in, week out is just immense.
Do you think it helped being on that perfect time to join Toulon, where suddenly you had all the superstars around you as well, and you sort of went on that journey that sort of kicked off Toulon's big run of the European Cup finals and obviously the top 14 or whatever it was?
100%. Believe it or not, I didn't know the roster. I didn't know the names in the squad. Toulon had actively tried to get me to sign 2 or 3 years before, and I'd said no because I wanted to go on another Lions tour and I wanted to go to another World Cup. They'd never really entered my mind frame until the 2011, and so I didn't do an awful lot of research. I knew Johnny was down there, I knew Joe van Niekerk was there, but aside from that, you know, I didn't really have any idea that the likes of Carl Heyman was down there, that Bakis Botha was going to sign, that Gitto was going to sign, you know. So I sort of went into it a bit blind. And then when I got there, I was like, Jesus, this is insane. The entire bench having, you know, 60 caps or more on the bench. I mean, it's bonkers. And yeah, it was absolutely perfect timing from my perspective. I mean, it meant I didn't have to play every week because the squad was so big and so talented. I got a massive kick out of playing alongside those players that you spend your entire lifetime playing against and you know, trying to get the better of. But once you're alongside them, then you get a true appreciation of how amazingly good they are. Because you always downplay how good they are when you play against them, clearly, because you want to kind of get mentally won over on them. So, you know, playing alongside Bakis Botha for my last couple of years was just extraordinary. Yeah, I realised that he was twice the player I thought he was when he played for the Box, because, you know, when he played for the Box, he did kind of two or three jobs incredibly well. You know, he was an enforcer, he hit rucks incredibly hard, smashed people in tackles, and was a general kind of nose around the pitch. But the guy actually had skills and ridiculous pace. I mean,
I've seen him so fast. When we played South Africa versus England at Twickenham, I passed, unbelievable, probably my first pass ever, to Dylan Armitage running down the wing, and Bakis Botha caught him. He was going to score, caught him, tackled him, got back to his feet and stole the ball. And I was like, oh my God, that guy's like 9 foot tall and about 130 kgs, and he can move.
Yeah. Seriously pacey. But you never saw that, you know, when he was playing for South Africa. You only saw the kind of grunt and grind.
Now, a lot of people don't know this about you, but we sort of got a little hint in your intro. You and I quite enjoy a little bit of a Sappuccino. We always sort of the negative side of life. That's what sort of gets us through. Is that fair to say?
100%.
That's how you and I bonded, just sitting at the back of a bus going, this is fucking shit. and then laughing about it. Obviously, yeah. France is notoriously not as professional as you would have, you know, wanted it to be. What was your Toulon adventure like from that point of view? Did you have to just disassociate yourself from all your past professionalism, just throw yourself into it? Was that difficult to adjust? There must have been a few negatives out there.
Well, the funny thing is, I seemed upbeat and positive. So, you know, from my perspective, there wasn't too much to moan about with regards to the professional game. And I'm not a great analyst of the game. I don't like video sessions. I don't like meetings.
What do you like? Yeah, you said, don't like weights, don't like training, don't like running, don't like this. What the fuck do you like?
Mole wrecking.
You just said I like to moan.
Yeah. So, moan and maul, well, and moles. Mole wrecking.
Yeah. I just looked at everything in France and just smiled. Players that go over there and think that they're going to change the French methodology or change their systems, you are literally wasting your time. There's little things that you can do, but really, it's like pushing treacle up a hill. When I played my first away game for Toulon, we got on a rickety old school bus and travelled, I think it was 10 hours across the Mont de Marsan or somewhere like that from Toulon. They had two drivers, so you didn't even really get a rest. One driver drove for 4 hours, the other driver took over. And most of that squad at that time were sort of certainly over 30, and got out the other end and like crippled. I mean, literally, kind of, like, had to literally unfold ourselves, and obviously lots of big guys in these ridiculously shitty bus. You know, I went out to Bernard Laporte and I said, Bernard, if you think I'm playing tomorrow, you are dreaming, mate. And he's like, what do you mean? I said, look, I can't. Literally, I'm bent over at right angles. I'm like in all sorts of trouble. And then got to the shittiest hotel in the world to, you know, see my cardboard bed. this is nonsense. So I said to him, look, there's no way I'm going to get on the bus next away trip. Just not going to do it. And he goes, what do you mean? I said, well, I won't be able to play. I'm telling you this now. I will play 3 games this season if you continue to treat us like that. I just won't physically be able to do it. So he says, what do you want to do? I said, well, I'll drive myself. I'll get in my car and I'll drive myself. He said, you can't do that. You can't do that. I said, well, you know, come up with a solution. So he said, well, why don't you go with the kit man? And the kit man has a kind of VW Caravelle, quite luxe, you know, high end. So I was like, fine, I'll put the seat back, heated seats on, I'll go with him. Now, this guy is called Gilles. He's got one eye. He smokes and also communicates on the telephone as he's driving at 150 miles an hour. And he gets you there like 3 hours earlier than the bus, but you are literally shitting bricks the whole way. So your tension in your body by the time you got to, you've done a week's worth of training just holding on. But anyway, I did it, managed to play the game, and then Backies comes up to you and goes, Shuzzy, I didn't see you on the bus. Why weren't you on the bus? I just said, I can't do it. And he goes, but are you getting back? And I said, well, I'm with Jill, the kit man. And he's like, oh, is there any space in there? And I was like, I said, there is. And he goes, right, I'm coming in. So then Backies came in the bus. And then Carl Heyman the following week was, well, where are you guys on the bus? So we had 3 in the minibus. And then someone else said something. And then we had another car of the physios. They decided they'd drive. So we had like, you know, 4 or 5 cars and the bus going. And I was like, Bernard, come on. We've got to do something about this. So they ended up upgrading the bus, which was not what I was after. I was obviously after flight.
Yeah.
And we got the occasional flights, but the flight was just always a carrot. Like Bourgelat would put this carrot, like, I'm giving you this opportunity to fly on a plane to get this result. If you don't get the result, you're walking back, or you can get your taxi back. I mean, he'd literally say that, and like a couple of people got fired as a result of not making the players find their own way back from games. I mean, it was just it was nonsense, but it just made me laugh. Everything made me smile and laugh in my experience.
Was he that renegade, Beaujolais? Like, obviously, you know, we've talked to players before and sort of talked about the French journey, saying that, you know, people are still trying to get money out of him now, even though he's not the owner. Everyone's suing him because he didn't pay. Was he as big a lunatic as everyone says he was?
Complete nutcase. Complete nuts. Yeah, I mean, when we won the Heineken Cup over in Dublin, he'd announced to the fan base of Toulon that he wasn't gonna bring the cup back. The European Cup wasn't anywhere near as important as the top 14 Brennus. It's just a step in the ladder, in effect. So we're going to go straight to Nantes to play the semi-final. So we're not bringing the cup back, even if we win it. Yeah, we haven't won a trophy in 30 years, but we're definitely not bringing the cup back. So fans, just, you know, you'll have to wait. Won the Heineken Cup, huge celebrations. He then announces to the press and to the local Toulon press, now, do you know what? The fans deserve this. I need to deliver the cup back to the Toulon faithful. So you imagine, you know, 150,000 people, I think, is the population of Toulon, but the Var region is enormous. So the whole of the Var region turns up to Toulon airport in expectation of seeing the team and deliver the cup. He flew back on his own. He flew like this jumbo jet on his own, and so it comes out, oh, I brought you the cup back. And we were all in Nantes. So like all the spectators are going like, where's Johnny? Like, where's Buffy's? And we were all sitting in this shitty hotel in Nantes, waiting to play the semi-final of the top 14. So he's just full on oddball.
And what was Bernard Laporte like? Because you hear mixed stories about him. Did he... or whether he actually coached, or did he just, because of the players that you had, he just let you get on with it, and the only time he sort of came down was if you lost the game, they'd come and bollock you and basically say that you had to do things differently? Or
I liked him. He's very straightforward, you know, will literally rinse you, and rinse anyone, by the way, like anyone. Johnny You know, Johnny Wilkins and Matt Gidd, rinse anyone if they feel like they're doing the wrong thing. You know, no one would literally stand up to him because he is a force of nature when he gets going. I mean, none of us can understand a bloody word he was saying because he does the whole thing in French. We're all like, he said, Tom Whitford, who's our team manager, he said he used to translate everything, but he certainly didn't. So it'd be like Bernard Laporte ranting and raving in French and effing and blinding in French. And Tom would go at the end of it, yeah, that was a bad pass. But it probably needs a kind of character like that to look after a group like that, because, you know, if you didn't have a strong character looking after, you know, world superstars, I mean, you forget that Toulon have had a long line of superstars in the past. You know, George Gregan's played there, Andrew Mertens has played there.
Sonny Bill,
yeah. So it's not like they've not had star quality in the past, but they've not had that strength of character at the helm to sort of push them through and onto obviously the big prizes.
I just wondered, because you said about you don't like training, you don't like running. Over there, what I heard, I think speaking to Carl Heyman once, is that you guys sort of dictated kind of the training. That there was a couple of obviously interesting coaches over there, and they were like, right, we're going to do this. And everyone was like, yeah, no, we're going to do this. Was there that vibe going on?
A bit of that. We didn't do contact for 2 years, and I'd like to think I was a major part of that. The very first session we did, as you can imagine, and I don't want to bag the French, because, I mean, they should really dominate the world of rugby, given the amount of talented players they've got. The first session we did, we said, right, we're going to do some contact, some ruck training. And as you know, like in the UK, it's like, when you're told you're going to do that session, it's full on. And you just go, you get into the mindset, it's going to be full on. There's no point in kind of go half measures, otherwise you'll get hurt. So a couple of the French contingent are sort of holding these sort of tackle pads a little bit warily. And I just thought, well, okay, I'm 38, going to this star-studded arena. I've got to make an impression early on. I've got to kind of make myself at least feel worthy of being in this company. So I just like, right, get your head on. Let's get into this first session. And we were doing like the equivalent of the minute drill. So you're just hitting one ruck after the other. And I just absolutely flew in and basically crumpled Maxime Mamoz into a pile. I think probably broke his leg, dislocated his did the whole 9 yards in one hit. And Bernard just went, finished. That was it for 2 years. Never do it again because he lost his star centre.
I love that, because you hated that as well at training. The amount of times I would see you in the early days where some keener would hit you, you'd get up, adjust your neck, shake your head, smutter to yourself and run off. So you turned into your worst nightmare just to impress a load of internationals.
It's the only thing I had at the end.
I love that. Look, can I just cast your mind back to Wasps in the early days? You obviously signed from Bristol, and your first season, am I right in thinking, was absolute toilet? Did you sort of think, what the hell had I signed up to here?
They'd gone from title holders to kind of bottom of the league. I'd like to think it wasn't because they signed me, but it was a weird one. I came off the back of the 97 Lions tour, which ultimately didn't pan out as I would have wished. It was also the season that the lineouts rules changed, so no lifting to lifting. And the second rows at the time were myself, Andy Reid and Damien Cronin. like none of us could. It was like a Rizzler under each of our feet when we jumped. So that wasn't great. But I don't know, it was a weird season where nothing really went right. I was heavily overweight. I got a virus in South Africa, nothing sexually transmitted.
I love how you had to put that in there. Good. Thank you for breaking that to our listeners. Yeah, brilliant.
So I didn't start the season off well. But we got to a final, I think. Failed miserably in that final, and then kind of things started to happen after that. But I don't know what it was about that season. It was pretty dark. There were lots of things. You know, the training facilities at WASP have never been the best. We've kind of never made it an excuse. But at that time, we were training at Sudbury. Our gym was literally not the squash court at Harrow School, But the viewing enclosure at Harrow School squash courts, I mean, it was insane how bad it was. You know, Phil Larder came up halfway through our season because we were having issues with our defence. And we went out to the training pitch and he is a sort of hardened northerner, just looked at the pitch and went, "You're not training all that." God, Jesus Christ. And just like bagged it and said, "How can you possibly expect to perform when you're training on these facilities?" So that was part of the problem. We had an exodus of players like Dean Ryan and Steve Bates and Rob Andrew up to Newcastle. There's lots of change and lots of reasons you could pin on it.
And then you sort of embarked on one of the most unique kind of journeys. I mean, when you look back at those WASC days, obviously, you know, you finished with some amazing highs with Toulon, but what do you feel and think when you look back at those WASC days and the amount of trophies you guys won?
There are moments when you look back and go, was that the difference? Is that why it happened? But realistically, there was a core group of players that were together for best part of 10 years. You know, 10 years, you know, I joked earlier about man and boy, but everyone in that core group, you know, went to each other's weddings. We all had kids at the same time. We all got married at the same time. We kind of share wedding anniversaries because they're all the same period. Yeah, we're all, you know, good players, really good players. Wouldn't say ultimate star quality players. I wouldn't even put myself in that category. I think just a solid bunch of really good mates. And it needed someone or a system to come along to make us that much better, but also to believe in ourselves, because I don't think we ever really truly believed in ourselves. It took basically Gats and Craig White and Strigeon and Sean Edwards to come along and give us that belief and tell us that with a bit of additional support by way of training methods and systems, we could take that step. And that's exactly what we did and never really looked back.
What does a Simon Shaw make of a Sean Edwards on first meeting? Like, how did you two merge on that? Because I think that's fascinating. I know everyone talks about Gats, but I want to know what you think of him and what he thought of you.
I absolutely love him. I've got so much time for rare, quirky individuals. I mean, I would always regard myself as a bit vanilla. And I was like the kid at school that sat alongside the naughty guy, because he just wanted to be entertained by the noise, not get in trouble. and Sean's one of those like unbelievable characters in life, and you can't help but love. I mean, I just thought he was actually one of the few coaches, you know, bearing in mind I played 23, 24 seasons, he was one of the few coaches that actually taught me anything. And that is no word of a lie. You know, I came into the game fairly late, sort of 16, and played well because of my bulk, because of my size, a little bit different to the average second row at the time, but not, like, I wouldn't say revolutionary, but sort of went along my journey, starting at Bristol, playing well, you know, putting in a good shift most of the time and getting to England level. But all along the way, no one ever took me aside and said, "Why don't you try this? Why don't you do this? He was one guy that did that a lot, you know, and he gives you tidbits all the time that you just think it's so simple, but so genius at the same time. But the flip side of that is he's an absolute loonbag, and you stand in awe of some of his quirky things, like his pummeling punch bags at 6 a.m. in the morning in his underpants. And it's just an extraordinary thing to behold first thing in the morning.
Was it hard when you made that decision to leave, or was it because, as you said, all the bits about the club had kind of disappeared and there was a few strands left? Was it made easier, or was it still kind of gut-wrenching? Because I know you obviously had Bristol in your early days, but you were synonymous with WASC. You know, you formed one of the most successful partnerships with Richard Burkitt, the Premiership's ever seen. You won everything there was to win, you know, and I know you're quite an emotional guy. You know, we're going to come on to some of the things about that later. It must have been very difficult to make that decision to leave essentially a family.
That's the thing, it wasn't ultimately, because I wasn't surrounded in the room by the same people. They were a completely different group, and I felt like I was the new guy, and I needed to go around the room and introduce myself to all the new players, all the new coaches, all the new stuff. And I was like, if I'm going to do this, I might as well do this in a different club with a different adventure ahead of me. And so it wasn't that difficult at all, to be honest.
Well, it also, you'd been had enough of being punished by Hask. He probably wasn't there. He was on one of his other 50 clubs that he'd been to. But how was it when Hask sort of joined and going through that? Did he fit into the group or was it, oh my God, this kid's not going to make it?
Hask first came on my radar when we went on a pre-season trip to Poland. Were you 16 or 17 at the time?
17.
But I was like, there's no way this kid's 17 because, you know, like I said before, I've never been one to use the gym terribly often, but like I was looking at this kid thinking, Jesus Christ, he's been working out.
But guilty.
I was just amazed that he's out and out. You know, it might be a veneer, but it's the confidence that came through, especially with the sort of, you know, the banter, the digs that you get at club level, you know, on a daily basis. You know, I think Scrivener made some comment the first time you walked into a room and you just literally sat him down with whatever comment it was. And I just thought, bloody hell, this guy's going to be something to behold, whether or not he can play or not. His banter's going to be good. But one of the most disappointing roomies I've ever roomed with.
Oh, really?
Shocking. Yeah.
I was actually going to tell that story because you said with Sean Edwards that, you know, you like to hang around at school, like sit next to the naughty boy and watch him. I think that's why we bonded, because I genuinely get moments in my career, especially at Watts. Obviously, you know, you're one of my kind of heroes, an incredible player. And I think you've done yourself a disservice in terms of, you know, you're probably one of the most skillful players I've ever played with in terms of your handling. Yes, you're a big dumper, but that's about 10% of what you have. And there's so many times that I've seen you sitting there looking at me across the room, kind of going, go on then. And that's what I got with that roommate. He honestly sat on the end of my bed. I went, go on, Hask. I was like, what, Shawzy? He went, entertainment. I was working on my laptop. And I was like, what are you talking about? You're like, no, come on. I asked to room with you because I wanted you to entertain me. And I was like, that's all I've got, mate. I'm really sorry. There's no crowd. There's no crowd.
Exactly.
Did he actually spend most of his time following Lawrence around trying to imitate everything that he was
doing?
No,
he spent most of his time editing his motivational videos of himself.
Stop perpetuating that shit rumour. Right, actually, you and I used to do loads of handling skills.
We put that out the back to the floor.
Do you remember we used to do, you and I used to do after most sessions, a little bit of extra handling, passing, skill stuff. I remember, you know, remember that was a really good highlight. I did tackling with Worsley, handling with Shawzy.
Yeah, and you used to, like, the right hand, you used to be able to catch the ball with one hand. The other one's like a brick.
It's better than Joe Worsley's fondue set he had. We just had two spikes to try to pierce the ball. Just before we move on to Lions, just give me, you know, your most memorable moment from those WASC days. Was it the drop goal? Was it the winning? Was it some off-field stuff? There must be something that really sits in your mind when you think back about WASCs.
I think, I'm not one for reminiscing or remembering particular incidences in games, or even like, I don't know how people do it. I don't know how people tabs of, you know, what the score was or how many tries they scored, anything like that. So the results are one thing. And, I loved the fact that as a period of time that was entirely in the professional era, albeit obviously year on year, it got more professional. I critique people a lot for this now because I see it a lot. We literally loved every minute of it, like embraced everything. So embrace the losses, doubly embrace the wins. It's not to do with alcohol consumption or it's just, you know, they are the best years of your life. And to finish a game or finish a championship and not truly embrace it and have a great time with the people that you've done it with is just a shocking, shocking shame if you can't. And I see, you know, teams and players come off pitches when they've won games and they're miserable. And they look miserable. And I think, what? How can you be miserable? You put all that work in, not just for the week, but for all the pre-season and everything and all the games that have gone before it. And you've done all the analysis. You've done, like, shed loads more work than I would have ever done. And you come to the end of it and you've, you know, the climax is that you either win or lose the game. And you've won it and you're miserable. And I get it because they're already thinking about, well, that could have been done better or this could have. But, you know, that will all be forgotten in a heartbeat, you know, when you've retired. I just think, you know, and the one thing that stands out for me in the WASC days, even in the Bristol days, is that everything was just a pleasure, you know, even the losses. And it's not to say that we didn't have a few drinks after the losses. It was just embracing everything that was great about it. And I think if you look at some of the teams that have gone on to embrace that, and you look at Saracens, and as a Wasp player, you want to look at them and critique them and say, well, it's false. They've made this thing up, this spirit that Saracens, okay, they might have done that to begin with, but the message is still the same. The message I kept hearing is that from their coaches and from the guys that funded them in the initial stages, this is the time of your life. These are the best years you will ever have, and you need to take it with both hands. And I totally agree with that.
You say that it wasn't all about the nights out, but Hasker has always told the Hawaiian night out where if people didn't turn up in their Hawaiian shoes, or they get someone would be chopping them up and making them into thongs. What nights do stand out for the Wasps? Because whenever we used to go down and play there, whether it be Bath or whatever, and we'd stay up, we'd always end up going out, and it was always, Wasps was one of those teams at that time who knew how to have a good night out and knew how to own London town. So which nights stand out really in your memories as a couple of the best ones?
Are you talking about the night I folded Hask into a pretzel?
I don't think we've even told that story where you and I were sitting on a bench opposite each other. And Tinsley's talking about the time, remember we went to the Mitre and we had Hawaiian theme and they cut my shorts into hot pants and cut Wellwood shoes into flip-flops, Church's handmade shoes. But on the same occasion, you and I tried to have a wrestle on the bench, and I thought, I'm going to take Shaw's a young pup, and you just folded me backwards. My spine has never been the same again. It was awful.
I did feel for you. When you said you were going to do that Velator thing, I thought, yeah, that's a brave call. Every bus trip, I mean, I love them all. I think, to your point earlier about our really bad season when I first joined Wasps, I got pretty disgruntled that we played on Sundays. So at Loftus Road and at Sudbury, we played our games on Sundays, and as I say, we were having a pretty poor season. But players at that time would, because it was a Sunday, there wasn't much to do. So you sort of, you know, did your thing, played the game, win, lose, or draw, you know, have a couple of beers at the clubhouse, and then go home. And it was all, I was like, wow, this is not what I signed up for. I come from Bristol to the big lights of the city thinking, oh, it's going to be, you know, we're going to have a whale of a time. It's, you know, London's a 24-hour city. There's something going on all the time. I was sharing a house with a guy called Johnny Irons in Maida Vale. And I just started saying, like, we've got to find a base for our Sunday nights out. You know, we've got to create much more of our aftermatch than it currently is. So I started exploring London's dark corners on Sunday.
And that's the excuse you're going with, is it? Trying to set up a base. That's the excuse. I like it.
Some pretty horrible places, I tell you, on Sunday nights. And then finally, we worked out there were a core group of us lived along the Fulham Palace Road near sort of Parsons Green End. And there was a pitcher and piano there. So we just said, like, we'll meet at the pitcher and piano every Sunday, win, lose, or draw. And if we play away on a Saturday and we get a good result, we'll do a Sunday session. There was an Aussie kind of bar manager there at the time, and he loved the idea. He was like, you know, you guys are in here every Sunday. You know, I'll put a promo on for you and get some good tunes going. And that's how the pitcher and piano on Sundays started. And a couple of months in, and there were lines, the queues down the road to get into the pitcher and piano on Sundays. And we kind of created that, which was an amazing thing.
That was legendary. The PMP nights out, they just sort of tapered off because all of you got missuses and partners and stuff just as I came in. I used to hear about the legendary PMP. I don't think I ever made it to one of them.
They just started using that excuse to the missuses. Yeah. That was when you were starting to turn up. They just started, he was off searching out another place that they didn't tell you about. You're still through the PMP.
I got, Shorzy, I want to just ask you something, you know, before we go on to Lions stuff. You say obviously about the playing side being the best days of your life. You obviously played until you were essentially 40. How is retirement for you? Did you miss it? Because you sounded almost slightly melancholy about those being the best days of your life. Have you found it hard, or are you happy, or have you not quite adjusted to it?
No, I've fully adjusted. It's a really strange one for me. You know, you hear some horror stories and you hear how people struggle in the kind of afterlife of rugby. I genuinely haven't, and I put that down to a number of reasons. I finished very much on my terms. I mean, I got offered a couple more extensions of my contract. I could have played at La Rochelle for a couple of years. I wasn't up to the training and didn't want to do it anymore. So I retired on my terms. But the biggest factor in finishing your rugby career is that you have a community of like-minded individuals around you on a daily basis. Like every single day you walk in, and if you're down, someone in the change room is likely to lift you, and there's a support network there in place. And the moment you get extract yourself from that, it's very difficult to replace it. And everyone talks about the change room and all that, so, and that's all part of it. But ultimately, it's a network of people. And I've been very, very active all my career in creating a bigger network beyond rugby. In the early days of amateur rugby, Bristol, I was the first one in the boxes because, well, someone would give you a beer. I mean, I you know, came from a junior club where I drink the dregs with my mates because we couldn't afford pints. So you're always on the scrounge, essentially. So I was basically going to the boxes on the scrounge, but then meeting people and engaging with people. And I just thought that was one of the most fantastic things about the rugby world was that ability just to rock up and talk to anyone and have a good time. And I've never been massively keen on talking about rugby, or I'm not an avid follower of the game. I don't watch games regularly. So I was always interested in what other people were doing and, you know, what careers they had and what interesting things they'd done in their lives. So I built up this network, huge network of people beyond rugby before I retired from rugby. And, you know, and that network of people have held me strong the moment I retired. And I didn't look back because I'd done everything I wanted to do on the rugby pitch in my career. So there wasn't anything that I felt, you know, really sad about or had any regrets about. So no, I was great. Literally the day I knew it was all over, I think I cried for 24 hours.
Really?
Literally. Yeah. And I didn't know how to stop. Didn't know what was going on. And Jane kept walking into the room. And I just kept on telling us, get out. And I was just, I literally couldn't stop. The moment that 24 hours, you know, the day later, we went out for a meal with a load of the players, because you know, it was off season, you know, long lunch, piss up. And that was it. I was fine. I was absolutely fine. That kind of 24 hour period of just going, and it was, I think it was just shock. It was just like, that is it. That's all over. Now you've got to move on. And the only other time that kind of overwhelming thing happened to me was when I got injured a few weeks out from our second final in top 14. And Bernard Laporte said, "Shawsey, I really want you to be up there with the squad when we play this game. I really feel it's important." I was like, "Okay, fine." I was like, "Okay, fine." So I went along, and I was in the hotel room, and the phone rang, and Tom Whitford, and I said, "Please, please tell me that Bernard Laporte's not asked me to hand out the shirts," because in France, the handing out the shirts is a big deal in finals, really big deal. And they put this massive thing into it. And I was like, "Please tell me he doesn't want me to do that." He said, "He does. He wants you to do it." I was like, I can't. He goes, "No, you have to. You don't have to say anything, but he wants you to hand out the shirts." He said, "But if you have a couple of lines, then it'd be great." I was like, "Oh, you just killed me." Anyway, so I got in the lift, and I was in the lift with Andrew Sheridan. He pressed the button to the bottom floor, and I said, "You're right? You're feeling up for it?" He goes, yeah. "I'm just a little bit excited, actually. I'm a little bit, you know, looking forward to, you know, who's going to hand the shirts out." I said, "Why is that?" He said, "Well, I've just seen who's handed the shirts out to Clermont." I was like, "Who's that?" And it was the French president at the time, Sarkozy. Like, "What?" He goes, "I wonder who we've got." And I sort of looked down and went, "Oh, for fuck's sake." crushed me with a look. And I was like, "Oh, Jesus." And then, so we got to the moment, and Bernard goes, "This guy is truly, truly one of the most special, spectacular players of his generation. And I'm thinking, don't fucking build it up too much." And he started crying. He was in floods of tears by the end of his chat.
God.
And I was like, "Oh, you've just broken me." So then by the time I got up, I started off on this kind of speech about the only thing truly important to me ever in the future is if someone's walking down the road with his son, And he looks over at me and on the opposite side of the road and points and goes, "Do you know that is son? That's Simon Shaw." You know, he was whatever. And I just started crying. And it was literally like taps. Come on, get on with this, get on with this. I was handing out shirts and everyone was crying as they came up.
Oh, my God.
Like the worst environment to create just before the day.
Tins, were you a cry? Do you ever cry? I've never asked you this. I know you said retirement was on your terms, but do you ever cry or ever?
Not really. You know, you're lucky if you finish on your own terms and how you want to. But I didn't cry in terms of that side of it. If you start talking about enough and the good times and the environments that were special, then I will well up.
Yeah, I had that when I spoke to the team, when I told everyone I was going to retire, I couldn't stop crying. That's what I always loved about you, Shawsy. I mean, you know, I want to go on to Lion stuff now, but just about what you combine kind of that hard physicality with emotion and wearing your heart on your sleeve. And I think that's pretty much a fair place to sum it up. I mean, you obviously got to play with Shawsy with England so many times. I mean, do you see that kind of similar qualities?
Yeah, I was actually going to ask Shawsy about his England career. How do you look back on it? Obviously, 71 caps, you played for, I don't know, 15 years for England or whatever. But do you look back at that England team and your England career? Because obviously there was a period where you and Clive didn't really get on and you could have had more caps. You should have possibly had more caps. But, you know, it was that era where, you know, the same faces always fitted. So do you still look back with England and go, what a great career I had? Or do you think about things that you might have missed out on? And, you know, obviously you got called up in 2003 after Danny got injured. But do you wish that had gone a little bit differently, or are you happy with it? You're still happy with it all?
Look, you can always look back and wish that things had gone differently. And I hate the saying everything happens for a reason, but part of what makes you the person you are is how you deal with situations. And I think the one thing I can look back and be very, very proud of is the fact that I've never given up. I've always given my all. And you look back as well and go, perhaps, you know, if I'd done that, or maybe it was completely out of my control. I mean, one of the things I think about now is that lineouts were not my thing. I mean, I was very heavy at the start of my career. I did an awful lot about it. I mean, I went from 123, 124 kgs to 118 in one off season. So I tried my nuts off to be the person that other people wanted me to be. I never shouted about it. I never pulled coaches to one side and said, look, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you picking me? You know, give me the reasons. And I wasn't forceful perhaps enough in that respect. But I always did everything I possibly could to make it difficult not to pick me. But there's certain things in certain positions that you cannot afford to not have in your armory. And if you don't have them, people will always judge you on that. So if you're a second row and if your line-out skills people don't feel are up to scratch, or it's not your kind of number one calling card, if there is someone in the same position who might not be as dynamic around the pitch as you, might not have the hands skills that you've got, might not be able to do X, Y, and Z, if they've got that one piece...
Drops a ball over the line in the World Cup final.
But it's very difficult to, you know, overcome that, because someone's preconception is a second row needs to deliver X, Y, and Z. All the other bits and bobs that might add up to, you know, way more positives don't matter in some coaches' eyes, which is what I liked so much about working under Gatz. It was much more about accentuating the positives, not accentuating the negatives. And I always felt that in England coaches' eyes, there's been this kind of question mark on my line-out ability, which has never been an issue for Wasps or Lions or anyone else.
Did you not see that with England, actually, in a lot of positions, that they're always so stuck on how many players could have played and would have probably done a better job, but they didn't have, say, the scrummaging ability, they didn't have the line-out ability? I think that's a very, very true point.
Look at one of the best players of our generation at Wasps, you know, Joe Worsley. You would not want for anyone else to do that job, scything down monsters left, right and centre, than Joe Worsley or a Dan Lydiate. But if there's something in the list of requirements for him that doesn't stand out, like lineouts or handling ability, whatever, that's it. It's a closed door.
We all love the drama of live sports, and this weekend won't disappoint. The midweek warm-up games are done and dusted, and it's full steam ahead to the first test this Saturday, the 24th of July. If last week's game against South Africa A is anything to go by, it's going to be one hell of a series. Watch every minute of the tour live on Sky Sports for just £18 extra per month for non-Sky customers. It's live rugby you just can't afford to miss. Head to sky.com/sports for more details. It's only live once. Don't miss it. Can we just cast your mind now to the Lions? I want to start with a quote because there's a lot of emotion around everything you do, as I think that's coming out on today's Good Bad Rugby, but especially around the Lions. Now, the selection happened the other day and there was a quote that kind of went up on your Instagram that said, on the eve of the squad announcement, the few players that have been privileged to have adorned the famous red jersey will be reminiscing. Many are called, few are chosen. It was my greatest honour to have represented the British and Irish Lions on three tours, two to South Africa. With great honour comes great responsibility. I wish all those players hopeful of joining this extraordinary club my best wishes, but know that this is only the start of a journey. Talk to me about you and the Lions. Three tours, you know, you famously got the test start in your last tour. What does the Lions mean to you? Obviously a lot from that quote.
Definitely does. It didn't at the start, and I didn't have any comprehension of what it was all about, to be fair. When I went in 97, it was all a bit of a kind of, I was on a train journey that was kind of out of control. You know, I got into the England squad, I played the whole Five Nations, I got into the Lions squad. It was all kind of, oh, this is relatively easy. This is, you know, I didn't perhaps appreciate the magnitude of what lay ahead and what it meant to play in the Lions shirt. And I think, you know, you never really appreciate something until it's taken away. I mean, the quote's been used a number of times, and we saw it in Sinclair's interview when he wasn't going to make this Lions tour, how much that hurts once you've tasted it, once you've been there. You know, certainly in my case, didn't fulfill my ambitions in the shirt, albeit, you know, I think I played very well. I think everyone in the 97 tour played very well. I think that's what's key to the success of a Lions tour. And, you know, this is playing out on this tour. There's no one really having any bad days. I mean, everyone's playing pretty damn well. I didn't feel like I could have done much more on 97's tour, but I didn't really throw my hat in the ring as much as I should have done, because what it came down to was ultimately Jeremy Davison, again, a much better line-out operator than I was, and he got the nod ahead of me. But also, you know, the England front five had a bad day at the office in one of the games that we lost. We only lost one game, and so that has a profound effect on selection, because you've got very few opportunities to show yourself, and if you're part of a losing team, then that's a bad notch on your resume. So going back to the point, if you have sampled it, you have tasted it, it's that much more of a driver in the future to achieve more in that shirt. And you know, everyone wants to first, you know, be on the list, be on the on get a plane ticket. Next, you know, you can't wait for the day that the shirt's handed over to you for your first start. Next, you want to be part of a test match squad. Next, you want to be playing in the test match. Then you want to be winning lines. So there's another peg to go after each and every time. And I just wanted to do every one of those things, as we all do as competitive beasts. You want to achieve everything you possibly can. And there's no better stage to do it on than in the Lions.
Obviously, Lions is different, but with your take to rugby and how your approach is that what makes Lions special? Is the fact that it fits into how you approach your life, living sort of at the moment? You've got to throw your hat into a whole new pool of players, get to know each other quick, which normally, look at 97's involved, the social side of it, and then you just got to be able to then go out and perform without all the detail that's been put in the past. Is that what excited you, meeting new people, new roommates, hopefully finding one better than Hask, and creating new friendships?
There's that, but also, as I said earlier about playing at Toulon, I'm a very laid-back guy. I'm the guy that needed to be punched in the face in the first 5 minutes to really get his game on. I would find it incredibly difficult in these strange times to play without a crowd. I mean, it would feel really, really odd to me. And hats off to the what they're doing out there. It's incredible. I loved the big stage. Every single time the stage got bigger, I felt I got bigger and played better as a consequence, because, you know, for whatever reason, that fueled me. And I loved playing away games, because the away games was, you know, the crowd was so much louder and more against you than anywhere else. So I loved playing at Cardiff, in Dublin, you know, in South Africa, in New Zealand. I loved the atmosphere. Obviously, there isn't a bigger stage than playing on a Lions tour at one of the big three nations of rugby. So the kind of convivial nature of the Lions tour and getting to know people and all that sort of stuff is fantastic as well. And I embrace that totally. I always felt a bit of a fish out of water with England, for whatever reason. I don't know. It's a weird one. You know, I got brought up in a expat community lifestyle where you had all sorts of different people from different nations coming together. So you know, I never really understood the anti-English thing or the conflict between the home nations. Never really got that. So I'd love meeting the Welsh guys and the Irish guys and the Scots. Yeah, I loved it.
Is it fair to say that kind of obviously in 97, you kind of, as you said, didn't understand it, and by sort of 2009, you kind of really realised it, and that performance you put in for so many is probably the greatest individual performance by a forward in a Lions shirt ever. Do you see that? I mean, how, you know, do you recognise how good that was?
Or who punched you in the nose?
I don't really. I honestly don't. I mean, I'll take it. 100% I'll take it, but I don't really see it that way. I mean, I just think, you know, on certain occasions, the build-up, the added pressure, there were a couple of changes in the squad that, you know, the management team and coaching team was basically said, with these changes, we were then a gnat's whisker of winning the first test. With these changes, the issues that we experienced in the first test in the scrum area and in the physicality, we will overcome with these changes. All that meant a lot of pressure on certain individuals, myself and Adam Jones being two of them. That added to the fact that it was my debut test as the oldest debutant test player. All that kind of added more and more to the media piece, if you like. You know, I don't think it was a 10 out of 10. I don't even think it was an 8 out of 10. With that kind of backdrop, it was a fantastic way to sort of round off that I'd been man of the match. And I think Barnsley, bless him, often, you know, makes his choice of man of the match in the first 10 minutes of most games anyway. and then lords the person up for the next 80. So he probably did that with me.
Obviously, after in the interview afterwards, you said you'd quite happily give up the man of the match to be hooked off before half time and win that game and go back. Do you look back now and still think that's the same way? You would still feel that way now, that you'd give that up just to get that win and be able to go to the third test play for a series, or as you said, even a draw to go to draw the series?
As long as I was picked for the third test.
That's a very good point. Actually, that's a very good point. You get the shepherd's crook before half time. You're not in that.
Yeah. You know, you'd never want to take those moments away, clearly, because they're your mementos. They're what makes your rugby career mean something, and they're great memories. But I think for the first sort of, I guess, 7-8 years of playing for England, and I remember this very clearly, I walked down around the outside of Twickenham Stadium with Lawrence and Jason Leonard going to our cars, and someone pulled up and went, "Oh my God, it's Jason Leonard and Lawrence Dallaglio." I think I had, you know, 20-odd caps by then. It's a bit of a nose-out joint, but it wasn't so much that they said it's Lawrence Dallaglio and Jason Leonard. Who wouldn't? Because, you know, they're iconic players. And it wasn't because they didn't know who I was particularly, but the fact that I was wearing an England tracksuit and I'm 6'9", and you might have thought they'd at least acknowledge me. that's a bit shit. And part of me kind of wanted that recognition in the England shirt, and I might not have got it in the England shirt, even though, you know, in 2017, you know, as well as I did, we went to the World Cup final, and it was the most special World Cup I've been involved with, and it was an amazing experience. But unfortunately, as you know, if you don't ultimately get the top prize, if you don't win that medal, then it almost doesn't matter that there's no prizes for second place, right? So that Lions performance, although it wasn't, you know, we didn't win the series, it's a picture postcard moment that makes me feel like I've kind of done my job. I've got the most out of the game and I've played at the highest level, even if it was for only 90 minutes. and I competed with the best. So, you know, Victor Macfield and Bacchus Bota, one of the best, and will go down in history as one of the best second row partnerships of all time. And I matched them on the day. And yeah, that means a lot.
Obviously, you know, like you just talked about the recognition for England, and there's so much about what we've talked about today is fueled by emotion. And I know you said it was the big media hype, but it seems to me that performance from you and then the utter desolation post-match was kind of almost like a watershed moment where you put so much effort into getting there to be that person on the other side, you know, walking along the street that the kid would point to and say, who's that? And then having that almost snatched away from you. Do you sit now, and I know you said you feel like the job's done, but do you sit now and do you feel any emotion? Because that quote that Tin said, I would rather have been taken off at halftime for playing badly than to one man of the match and to have lost, to be honest. I would rather have won this game and played badly. That's a massive statement to say. You know, now we're however many years on, we're facing a new tour back to South Africa. What sits there? Job, you know, do you sit comfortably? Do you sit with the job's not done, or do you feel like you still could have done more?
I don't think I could have done any more. I really don't. You know, as we've done on multiple occasions, you sit around a corporate table and, you know, someone on that table won't have a scuba who you are. They turn around to you and say, well, how many times? And you said five. They'd be, oh my God, that's absolutely incredible. You played for England five times. You have to put it into context. Like, that, yeah, clearly there are iconic players that will go down history and you know, you can sit there and all day and go, well, I was as good as him, or, you know, I could have matched him on my day and all this sort of stuff. I think you just have to go away on reflection and go, yeah, I put a bloody good shift in and I did everything I wanted to do. The trophies that we won at Wasps, I think I won 13, 14 titles with Wasps. People would literally pay huge amounts of money to have been at that many finals, let alone win that many titles. So I am totally made up with what I did on limited skills.
I think you're being very unfair to yourself.
No, but I genuinely believe that because I look at players of our generation, another generation. I say this to my kids all the time. I'm like, there are so many people out there, players out there, that are infinitely more talented than the ones that have that position in the squad, you know, in terms of their skills and abilities. But don't put it in. Don't put the hard work in. Don't put the efforts in on the day. I mean, my last 5-6 years of my career, I literally couldn't do an awful lot. And I genuinely mean that. I literally just thought, well, what can I do? I can hit rocks. I mean, I never used to hit rucks. You know, in the first sort of 10 years of my career, I used to hang around in the backs, hoping that one of the centres might see me and pass me the ball. For the last 5-6 years of my career, that's all I did, hit rucks and become an incredibly painful nuisance at ruck time and mall time and stuff like that. You know, so, you know, you've got to know where your place is. And I think at every stage of my career, I knew where my place was.
I would sit in your category in terms of I always knew that there were better players out there, whether it be Matthew Tate, more skillful than me or whatever. But there's a big thing for kids who listen to this show or whatever to go away from. It's having that ability to mentally reproduce performances. And I think that's something that was one of your massive strengths. And I do see now, you know, you will always see an unbelievable club player who might not ever then get to that lofty heights of playing for England or playing for the British and Irish Lions. And a lot of that will sit with their mentality. So, as you said, if you have the ability to work hard and take that onto a field, that is a bigger strength than a lot of other skill sets that look more obvious on a rugby field. And that is what you had in abundance. And, you know, I think having that ability to enjoy yourself off the field allows you to enjoy yourself on the field and perform at that highest level. So we can only commend you for that.
Jules, just a word on the current trip to South Africa. How hard is it to play in South Africa? You know, and also what do you feel the tour, you know, how do you feel this Lion side from what you've seen, if you have seen it, it's going
to
do?
I have to say, I haven't seen a massive amount of it. It's like with most Lions trips, you know, you've got the creme de la creme playing against, you know, I mean, club sides, provincial sides, not with all their superstars. So you're always going to get relatively easy games, some more testing than others. And, you know, I'm a huge Marcus Smith fan. I have been since literally the first time I saw him, which was, you know, 2 or 3 seasons ago. I just think the guy's superbly skilled. He's just got everything, confidence, the lot. You know, watching him the other night just fit into that shirt so incredibly well. But then you just have to keep reminding yourselves that they're not against the box. They've not got to that level of the game. And one of the things that I will always take away from any test match encounter versus South Africa is just the intensity of the contact area. There's nothing like it, really. I mean, even, you know, you even play the All Blacks, it's a different proposition. The South Africans are the most physical side in the world. You know, you can talk about Samoans and Tongans. They don't do it in every single facet of the game. The South Africans do, and it's a painful experience. And you have to back yourself to compete physically with them. There is no other way, unfortunately. You can sort of add all the tricks in the world to what you're going to do on the day, but physicality has to be at the forefront of that. I just don't want this Lions squad to be unprepared for that. And you know, there's enough people a lot cleverer than I am that would be shouting that in the change room and making them well aware of that. So it's the most testing environment, especially for a forward.
You just said about the physicality from one, you know, 23 season man to another veteran that's just managed to get himself back from what looked like a dislocated shoulder to get back on tour. How big is that to have someone of Alan Wynne-Jones's character get back on that tour and actually get 28 minutes under his belt on the weekend and seem to be fine? I mean, he's bionic man, but he obviously looks after himself. How good would it be for everyone else, and what a lift would that be to the Lions to have their captain back on tour?
It'd be a huge lift. Obviously, he toured with me in 2009, and it was funny because he reminded me a lot of myself when I first toured. You know, he was out every night enjoying the experience to the full, taking his shirt off and getting all excited. And I thought, wow, this, you know, and he was a great player then. And obviously, what he's gone on to do since is just extraordinary. I actually didn't have too many doubts once people were made aware that he might come back from this injury in time. I actually didn't really doubt that. I had an injury similar to that in a Six Nations game and came back 3 weeks later in the same Six Nations. So that it is possible. And he's clearly, you know, he wouldn't be there 12 years on if he didn't have one of those bodies that recovers well and you know, responds well to treatment and you know, has that kind of rehabilitative nature to it. So, you know, I don't doubt that he's fully fit and raring to go. And I think what he'll add to the change room, even if he doesn't start in the first test, even if he's just in the change room, is huge, absolutely huge.
Shawsy, I've absolutely loved having you on. I know Tins has as well. You've had such an extraordinary career for WAS, for Bristol, for Toulon, for England, for the Lions. You are 100% that man in the street where a kid will spot you and say, "Daddy, who's that massive man?" And they go, "That is Simon Shaw. Great on the piss, great on the field, not so good with technology."
It's amazing that you've actually attempted also to make a rugby ball that Haas can actually catch with Shaw grip technology.
Especially designed grip. Yeah.
It's got finger holes already in it. And you wear magnet gloves.
Right. Okay, lads, remember who's fucking presenting the show. Thanks very much for everything. Shawsy, you've been absolutely brilliant. We've been the good, the bad and the rugby in partnership with City Index. We'll be back next week, and so will Alex. So for the first and last time, let me say, until then, here's Rob Brydon.
Thank you so much for listening to the good, the bad and the rugby. It can't have been easy.